Welcome back to our second panel discussion on climate change for the day. Our first discussion focused on how culture and art has the power to ignite change. And now we would like to turn our focus on the science behind the critical issues within our environment, and in particularly within the Southwest and Texas. It is my great pleasure to introduce Diana Liberman and John Nielsen Gammon. Diana Liberman is an Oxford Fellow and co-director of the University of Arizona Institute of the Environment. And she joined in conversation today with John Nielsen Gammon, who is a regents professor in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences for the Texas A&M University, and also serve as the Texas State Climatologist. It is my great pleasure to have them both here, and please join me in welcoming them. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I suppose we're here to provide some scientific data, and of course we brought along our own PowerPoint slides to provide the proper atmosphere for science, but we're also going to touch on some broader social issues. Personally, I get very little opportunity to do that sort of thing. Being a state climatologist, when I'm talking about drought and climate change in front of a group, is usually I can assume that there's a large portion that strongly believes in the importance of climate change, and there's also a large group that strongly believes it doesn't exist at all. And so my task is essentially to get information to them, useful information, in a sort of way that they can all utilize it, rather than one side or the other being turned off and not listening at all to what I have to say. And I view this talk as being sort of the opposite of that, where I can actually raise issues that people would disagree with and encourage those disagreements. And if at the end of the talk there are 20 people that come up and all of them want to argue about a different thing about what I said, that's a successful talk. So I encourage disputes, whereas normally I try to encourage calmness. So the set of slides I have here starts with some slides on the Texas drought of 2011 and 2012 and counting. This is a product we produce at our own office, and it shows the rainfall over the 6 months, which is an agriculturally sensitive time period. And we scale it based on the historical rainfall for each individual location. So the scale ranges from exceptional drought, which would be dark red, which would happen only about 2% of the time at a given location, and all the way up to exceptional wetness, which is the top 2% of rainfall. And back in September 2010, things were looking excellent across the state. And 1 year later, things were looking quite a bit different. We had, turns out the color scale that we had devised was not adequate. There should be a couple of levels beyond exceptional to talk about how dry it was. Driest 12 months on record for Texas by a large margin. We had some recovery this year. We've had normal rainfall across the state, but if you still look at the longer time scale, which is where you start getting into water supply issues, you still got some serious rainfall deficits across the state. And it's interesting how the water system and water supply has responded to this, because there are differences in the ability of different places and cities and regions to adapt to drought and recover from drought, just as there are going to be differences in responding to climate change. So I've got a few graphs of reservoirs across the state. This is Lake Tewakene, which is up around the Dallas area. It's an example of a water supply for the Dallas region. And up top, I've got 20 years worth of the capacity. And at the bottom is just showing the last year. And so this particular drought in that part of the state wasn't the worst drought in the past 20 years. It didn't quite dip down below what happened back in 2005 and 2006. And it recovered with normal rainfall during the most recent year. So everything is well and good, really, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Move a bit farther west to central Texas. This is Lake Buchanan, which is part of water supply for a large portion of central Texas, which includes the city of Austin, as well as the original community for which it was built, which is a large area of rice farmers on the Texas coast to provide a reliable water supply. And this year is the first year that their reliable water supply was actually non-existent because the variety of reasons different as Texas grew and as Austin grew, there became more and more demands on the water and more uses beyond what it was designed for. So there was some recovery with normal rainfall with this lake, but still it's down about as low as it was this time last year. In response to serious restrictions on withdrawal of water from there. Go even farther west. This is Lake O.H. Ivy, which is a major water supply for the San Angelo region. And now you see, first of all, it didn't recover from the drought. The lake never really had an uptick with normal rainfall this past year. And one thing that's going on as we're going from east to west across the state is we're looking at places that normally get 30, 40, 50 inches of rainfall. Move to the center part of the state, normal rainfall is about 20 inches. Western part of the state, normal rainfall is around 10 inches. And to get serious runoff, first you have to get the ground moist and wet, and then rain that falls on top of that is able to run off. But normal rainfall in West Texas is often not even enough to get the ground moist. So you don't get the runoff with regular events. And you can see this longer-term decline in rainfall, in reservoir levels, which I think is partly driven by the rising temperatures that we're experiencing as well as the increased water demand. I often tell people in Texas, water supply over the long-term climate change is basically the second biggest concern, the biggest concern being population, but yet Texas, in its statewide planning, doesn't really take into account climate change, even though it's one of the major drivers of external drivers of water supply. And finally, Lake Meredith up in the Amarillo area, they've basically given up on surface water as a source, and they're relying entirely on groundwater now. So there's places that can get by with a drought and are back to normal a year later versus places where there's a fundamental change in where the water is coming from. In addition to the extreme drought we had last year, we also had extreme heat. This particular graphic tends to attract the most attention. I'm plotting rainfall going from left to right, so dry is on the left and wet is on the right during the summertime period when you really need the rain. And then going upward is temperature during the summertime, and you can see there's a strong relationship there. When it's dry, it tends to be hot. And if you were designing a climate, you'd probably want things going the opposite way, so that if it was hot, at least you're getting enough water. But it doesn't work that way, unfortunately. Dry leads to hot, which leads to more dry, and things roll over on each other. Each one of those dots represents 1 year in the climate record from 1895 to 2010. And here's 2011. Definition of an outlier, really. And sometimes people fall into the trap of looking at this and say, ah, the climate has changed. Not really. This one point doesn't do that. One point is an outlier. And climate change may have contributed to it, as I'll show in a moment. But there's also a lot of things that happen randomly that simply our lifetimes are too short to perceive as being a normal event. Drought. The whole southwestern United States is very subject to drought, both on a short time scale and a long time scale. Droughts back well before European settlers have had major impacts in the region. And even without climate change, it will continue to have an impact, but unfortunately we're adding to those impacts with what's happening with the climate. What I want to show here is a little bit of a study that we've made on the causes of the drought. So up top, we've got the lack of rainfall last summer, and then the heat centered on Texas and Oklahoma. Oklahoma is very upset that we call this the Texas drought, but that's their problem. Middle row is what you get if you take a computer model that simulates the weather and the atmosphere, and you put in the observed ocean temperature conditions that we had. So it shows how much of the weather was driven by what the ocean was doing. And it turned out we had a La Nina in the Pacific Ocean, and that tends to lead to warm and dry conditions. And indeed, this shows that on average, should be warm and dry with that, although not as warm as was observed, and we even had to crank up the scale here. So it really got the location right, but didn't get the strength of it. On the bottom is results from climate change scenario simulations with increase of greenhouse gases. And of course, they show that it's like the bathtub where the level is rising everywhere. The temperatures are going up on average. And so that's intensifying any extreme warm conditions, and it's mitigating any extreme cold conditions. But in addition to those individual simulations, those are actually the averages of a whole bunch of model runs. So now each one of these dots is an individual simulation. And the only difference in those, the only way we got a different dot for each of those is by starting the simulation with a slightly different starting point, slightly different initial condition, almost indistinguishable. And this shows, with that spread, how much of what happened was actually just randomness due to the weather. People really like to have explanations for the things that are happening to them. And when I say that a large portion of the drought was luck, they don't tend to be satisfied with that explanation. So I call it internal atmospheric variability. It sounds much better. But there's an analog there between that and longer-term climate change, which is just like we can predict, to some extent, seasonal weather based on El Nino and La Nina. There are a lot of other factors that we can't predict. And the same thing applies to climate change, which is why we call the model simulations projections rather than predictions, because there's this whole long list of things that affect climate, from solar variability all the way down to atmospheric chaos on the bottom, which is what I just called luck a minute ago. And if you go through the list and knock off the ones that are, first of all, important on the short time scale, we don't really have to worry about changes in the Earth's orbit. That's the ice ages that are influenced by that, but over the next 50 years, not a problem. But a lot of other things we have to cross up because we can't predict them very well. Solar variability is not very predictable. We can go out maybe 5 or 6 years with the solar cycle right now. That's about it. Volcanic eruptions, there's no way to predict those, but they have major impacts on climate when they occur, especially if they occur in sequence. It's probably one of the main reasons why the period of time from in the 50s and 60s to the early 70s was not strongly rising temperatures. We can't predict oceanic variability, although we're working on it. We'll probably have reliable decade-scale predictions of what's happening in the ocean within the next few years. We have the prototypes in place now. And, of course, luck you can't predict. And so all that's left is those three. And so we can't. Even if we could predict the consequences of those three things exactly, we still wouldn't be able to say what the climate's going to look like in 50 years, because there are a lot of other wild cards in place. All we can do scientifically is say, well, this is the expected value based on what we can predict. What's going to happen could be different in either direction, and there's no way to say. So the climate models are not producing a worst-case scenario or the best-case scenario. I want to wrap up by going back to Texas and show what the projections are compared to what has been happening. And I'll start with rainfall. Rainfall in most of Texas has been increasing fairly steadily. You can see the drought of the 1950s here, but otherwise it's gone up in most parts of the state by about 10 to 15% over the past century, which is what the graph on the left covers. The exception to that is West Texas, including the Marfa area, which has been flat or maybe has gone up only a few percent. But the large variations in there are responding to both El Nino, La Nina, and longer timescale processes in the ocean. Over on the right are climate projections of rainfall, and they're going in the opposite direction from what rainfall has been doing. So there's an open scientific question as to whether that is going to happen or not. But even if the models are right, it's a small change compared to the natural processes from the atmosphere and ocean that lead to these large swings. So the Southwest has always had to deal with large swings of precipitation. And at least for the time being, climate change is not going to overwhelm that. But what climate change will overwhelm natural variability for is temperature. Again, temperatures in different regions of Texas in the past, as well as going forward into the future. And what we see here is that we're already out at the high extent of what has naturally happened across the state, well, partly naturally, partially man-made. But the models with their temperature projections, which is the most robust part of the model projections, show a steady increase at about the same rate the temperatures have been increasing since the 1970s and 80s across the state of Texas. So that 5 degrees Fahrenheit by the middle of the century above what we've been used to, which means that last summer, which was like 8 degrees Fahrenheit above normal, we're gradually becoming toward that being the new normal, but it's still going to be unusual. It'll just be a lot more common than before. And beyond that, it's hard to say. And the projections of drought in Texas actually mainly come from the temperature, because of even if you have the same amount of rainfall, evaporation is going to draw it out of the soil faster. There'll be less stream flow. Reservoirs will be losing water faster. At the same time, plants will be needing to utilize water more because of the increased temperatures. So it's the combination that's happening. It's not just the rainfall. It's how everything interacts that produces the dry conditions. And I'll let Diana go into more detail about some of the projections and some of the things that are going on both globally and regionally.
Okay. Okay, so I'll try not to overlap with John too much. I'll go fast when I'm repeating what he said, but this is such an important issue, it bears repetition. So I'm at the University of Arizona, and the Institute for Environment that I co-direct coordinates a number of centers on research on climate change in the Southwest. So I'm part of an interdisciplinary center, and I consider interdisciplinary not only to be the natural scientists working with the social scientists, but also working with the arts and humanities. So we have people from the arts and humanities that are associated with some of our projects. And so one of the reasons I'm here is because we've just completed a report for something called the National Climate Assessment, which is going on this year, which is trying to assess what we know about climate change in different parts of the United States. So I'll be giving you a little bit of an update of some of the things that are about to be published about the Southwest and the climate assessment. But the other reason I'm here is that for a number of years now, through my job at Oxford University in the UK, I've been engaged with Cape Farewell. David Buckland got in touch with me a number of years ago, and I was really excited and interested about the opportunity to work with artists in the cultural sector. And it was partly in the hope that they could inspire the understanding and action that I didn't think scientists were doing such a great job at. And so I've enjoyed working with Cape Farewell as a sort of a science advisor, meeting the artists and being involved in a number of their exhibitions and helping to stimulate some of the expeditions like the one to the Amazon, which was coordinated through Oxford. And for me, going around the Borum exhibit, the Carbon 14 exhibit, I probably read it very differently, being a scientist, from some of you. I'd be quite interested as a social scientist to know how you reacted to going around the art exhibit, if you have, because I saw things a lot about the causes and consequences and the responses of the challenges we're facing around environmental change. I saw artwork that talked about the rise in greenhouse gases. I saw work that created empathy about what was happening in the Amazon, in the Arctic, and in small islands, and also work that related to the increases in fire intensity that we're seeing. And so I'm actually really interested to talk to people about how they reacted. And in fact, my colleagues who are here from University of Arizona would probably like to talk to you about it as well. So let me move to the first slide is something you all know about, I know, which is the Fort Davis fire. I found it an incredibly powerful image. And it reminds me of Tucson because we're surrounded by telescopes as well that are constantly and increasingly threatened by the fires that are breaking out in the Southwest every year. But the news that's most recent, I think, for most of you, if you paid attention, was the news last week about what's happening to the Arctic sea ice. And the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder last week reported that the melting of the ice during the summer was the greatest it's ever been in 33 years. What happens is that about every year, it used to be that during the Arctic summer, about a third of the Arctic would melt away during the course of the warming over the summer. And so normally it would go from about 14 million square kilometers to about 8. But this summer it's dropped to 4. So it's dropped to about 25 to 30%. And we haven't actually finished the melting of the Arctic summer. So this slide, you can see the 2012 melting and how dramatic it is compared to the long-term average and how much has melted. It's not actually ice-free at the moment. What it is but the Northwest Passage is now ice-free. So you can go through it on boats. And of course, that's a concern because a lot of people want to take the oil through the Northwest Passage now because it's ice-free. Show a couple more slides that are more global than the ones that John was saying, showing. This is the This is the latest data on global temperatures. They're now actually about 1.2 degrees centigrade higher globally, warmer than they were a century ago. That's about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. This July was the warmest in the US in a very long time. And the Southwest as well is warming. And this graph you've probably seen, it just shows that in the sort of first part of the 20th century, we were cooler than average. And now really ever since 1980, the planet as a whole has been getting warmer and warmer and warmer relentlessly. I'll skip this one because this is the more national picture of the drought. But one of the things perhaps I would mention is although Texas has been the focus of attention on the drought, of course, now the attention is in the Midwest because they're in deep drought. And that's what's starting to raise serious concerns about food security. And the concern it raises in Texas is because of what it's going to do to the feed prices for the livestock or what that people are concerned about in the long run. I rather than show you data on what's happening to the dams in the West, this is actually a photo of Elephant Butte Dam. And the dams on the Rio Grande and on the Colorado are very low. They have been for a number of years. I think I found Elephant Butte at 12% of its capacity. Lake Powell and Lake Mead, they're a little bit up higher than they were, but they're still only around half their capacity. So this is really serious when we have these reservoirs that we all depend on and that many ecosystems depend on. So I think, and this is just the image of the fires across the West this summer. And in fact, perhaps some of the worst fires have been in Colorado and now in Oregon. And there is analysis going on. My colleague Tom Swetnam was on Science Friday last week on NPR talking about the increased intensity of the fires that we're seeing across the West. But what I want to do now is just shift from the impacts to what's causing these changes in climate. And the point here is that the greenhouse gas emissions are now higher than they have been for 600,000 years. And so if you look at this slide, you can see that up until 1950, we're down under 300 parts per million in the atmosphere. This is the long-term concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. You can see them varying, and that's partly to do with the ice ages. But in the last 60 years, they've just gone up very dramatically. And we're now at almost 400 parts per million of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And this is unprecedented in terms of the human impact on the atmosphere. And this, along with many other changes that we are, many other pressures that we're putting on the global environment, is why a number of scientists are now saying that we're in a different geologic epoch. We've moved out of the period where the conditions of the planet were controlled by natural processes, and we're now in an epoch that is controlled by humanity. And that's partly greenhouse gases, but it's also land use change. It's also what we're doing to biodiversity. It's also what we're doing in terms of water pollution. But we are now in the Anthropocene, which is this new epoch where we dominate the planet, and that brings different responsibilities to us in terms of our need to think about how we manage the planet. And just to give you a little bit more of a window on the way in which we're transforming the planet through greenhouse gas emissions, and these are mostly from our use of fossil fuels, mostly from coal and oil, but also gas. And then about 20% of the change is from land use change. And a lot of people always think, oh, that's deforestation in the Amazon. But in fact, the Brazilians have been very successful at stopping deforestation in the Amazon. So we're actually looking much more at what's happening in Asia and in Central Africa. As peace comes to Central Africa, deforestation is increasing. And there's a couple of interesting things I'd like to point you to here. Despite all the efforts of Cape Farewell and the scientists and even the policymakers who have made decisions in California, where they've committed to reducing emissions by 80%, in Europe, where the countries are taking global change very, very seriously, despite all those policy efforts, the greenhouse gases are continuing to increase, and they're actually increasing faster than they ever were. So if you look here, you can see that the greenhouse gas emissions grew at 1% in the 1990s, 3% in the 2000s, and are now over 5%. And you can see a really interesting blip here in 2009, which was the recession. And some people thought that that was going to be a great blessing for the planet because it would be reduced emissions, but we've already recovered from We haven't recovered from the recession economically here, but the planet has recovered from the recession in terms of global greenhouse gas emissions, partly because of the emissions increase in the developing world, especially China. And I just wanted to bring it back home. In the Southwest assessment, which actually doesn't include Texas, there's a separate assessment for Texas, we've actually looked at the responsibility for emissions in our part of the world. But I've recalculated some of the data from EPA to take a look at what our responsibility is for these increased emissions and for our role both nationally and globally in the emissions increase. So the US is currently contributing about 18% of all the world's greenhouse gas emissions, and we're by no way 18% of the world population. I think we're less than something around 2 or 3% of the world's population. The Southwest, excluding Texas, if you actually then calibrate the emissions from the Southwest, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, Colorado, and Texas, amazingly, we are responsible for 5% of the world's global greenhouse gas emissions, just that corner of the United States. And of that, Texas is about half of the emissions for the Southwest. And there's an amazing data set that came out last year. And my colleague, Don Grant, at the University of Arizona has been analyzing that data set. And that data set is both shocking, but also lends hope. Because the data set from EPA shows the greenhouse gas emissions from individual facilities over a certain size all across the US. And I was just just looking at the data that included Texas in the broader Southwest last night. And what you can see is that of all of those emissions from the Southwest, a third of those emissions are from only 20 facilities. So when we talk about what all the individuals could do, what we really need to do is to be focusing on those 20 facilities, because if they, and they're all utilities and generating stations. And half of the emissions in our region, Texas to California, are from only 50 facilities. So perhaps we need to focus on helping the government and helping those companies become more efficient, switch to renewables, because that's the majority of our emissions, and we can't do it all through individuals. So now I just want to talk a little bit about the latest projections we've come up with for climate change in the Southwest, and I'll do that fairly quickly. These are from the Southwest report that is available through the Institute for Environment at the University of Arizona, and we're going to be actually publishing a book fairly soon from it. And I just want to show you some of the projections for the Greater Southwest of what will happen if we don't turn those emission trends around. If we continue business as usual along a sort of a worst case scenario in terms of emissions to the atmosphere. And as you saw, there's no sign that we're turning it around. Remember, the emissions are increasing globally faster than they ever were. Then these are projections of what things are going to look like in 2050, 2070, and at the end of the century. And you can see here a worst-case scenario on the far side there, where in summer we would see temperatures of 9 degrees Fahrenheit warmer in the Southwest. And one of the things we want to talk with you about is how could we cope with that? How could we adapt? And then similarly, these are the latest model results on what will happen to precipitation, snow, and rain in the Southwest. And again, if you go to the far side by the end of the century, you can see summers are 20% drier. And you combine less rainfall with higher temperatures, and that's where you start to see an increase in the frequency of droughts. This does combine them into the predictions of what will happen to runoff across the West under these high-end emission scenarios if we don't act. And you can see that large areas of the West would have 20 to 40% flow in the rivers. And that's perhaps what we're starting to see. In fact, my colleague Jonathan Overpeck was quoted this summer as saying, this is what climate change would look like. What we're seeing right now may not be exactly climate change, but it's what climate change may look like. I'll skip that one. And to sort of move towards the end of my presentation, we're not just concerned about long-term trends. One of the things that I think brought David Buckland and some of the artists to become even more concerned about the planet and the climate was a paper that colleagues of mine published a few years ago about the potential of tipping points. And this is that we're reaching points where we're reaching thresholds in the impacts that we're having on the planet. There are possibilities that we're going to reach a point where the Amazon, for example, where Adrian and others did the expedition, may become so much warmer and drier that it flips from being a forest to a grassland. And when that happens, grasslands do hold carbon, but there could be a big bump in emissions to the atmosphere. Similarly, in the Arctic, we're starting to see the methane released from the soils as the soils get warmer. And that, too, can lead to a feedback effect where suddenly we get very dramatic increases in greenhouse gas emissions and the climate starts to change even faster. So the map that I'm showing you here shows a number of places where those tipping points might occur. And this is a very powerful image, I think, of us potentially sort of going over the cliff. So a group of us a few years, about 3 years ago, got together because we weren't just worried about the climate change tipping point. We're worried that the human impact in the Anthropocene, the human impact on the planet, is actually not just tipping the climate, but is tipping biodiversity, is tipping pollution levels, is tipping waste levels. And so we came up with this idea of planetary boundaries. And much to the dismay of some of our fellow scientists who feel as though everything's so uncertain, you can't give clear guidelines to the decision makers, we decided to grit our teeth and come up with a set of boundaries. And they're safe boundaries. They're before you reach the cliff. And so our recommendations are that we shouldn't ever have gone above 350 parts per million of greenhouse gases. We're now at 400. We need to back off from that as fast as we can. And in terms of the impacts that we have on land use or the amount of fertilizer we use, we really need to move ourselves back to stay within the safe boundaries. So this is just the diagram of the recommendations that we've made. And there's a big squabble in the sciences about this. And our answer when people disagree is to say, come up with a better guess, because the policymakers are asking us for some guidelines about how much safe space do we have for development, and when are we going to hit points where we get irreversible or abrupt environmental change. And this just gives you a sense of how we're moving towards the planetary boundaries. And I had the privilege of showing this graph to the Dalai Lama a year ago. And it was sort of humbling to show it to him, because he influences the behavior of such a large group of humanity. And what we see here is the movement towards the planetary boundaries over time. And so what you see here is in the 1800s, we're well within the boundaries. Then in the 1950s, we start converting agricultural land, we start emitting greenhouse gases. And to make it quick, I'm now going to jump to the present day of where we think we are in relation to the boundaries. And you can see here that we, the estimate in our paper is that we've exceeded the climate boundary. We're in an unsafe space. We've exceeded the boundary for nitrogen pollution. We're creating dead zones in the ocean. And we are destroying biodiversity at an unsustainable rate. The rest of the boundaries, we're still in a safe zone, but we are moving towards them fairly rapidly. So this is my last slide, which is really to get the conversation going with John and with the audience, is I think that we know we're already committed to some degree of climate change. Unless we geoengineer, and we could talk about geoengineering, unless we geoengineer, because the greenhouse gases stay up there for up to 100 years, what we've put up in the atmosphere already has committed us to a certain amount of change, also because we've warmed the oceans. So we've got to figure out how to cope with that change. Then if we don't prevent more emissions, we've got to figure out how to cope with the change that's still to come. And the other things that I've noted here are two things that worry me. One is we don't cope very well with existing climate variability. We're not able to sort of prevent suffering when Hurricane Isaac comes ashore. There's so many people already vulnerable. We need to work on sort of the adaptation gap before we even think about future climate change. The other thing is our infrastructure lasts for so long. A recent study shows that even when the engineers plan for only 30 years, most of our buildings and our infrastructure is there for 100 years. So if we build a fossil fuel station now, we're stuck with it for a very long time. And so this is why I think also we need to think about adaptation, because of the long-livedness of infrastructure. And the final reason that I want us to think about adaptation is that there are some win-wins. There are things we can do with buildings, with renewable energy, with coastal defenses that both make us safer from climate risk and also reduce emissions. And we need to be looking for those win-win solutions in adaptation. So I'll end there, and we're going to have a little chat, and then we're happy to have lots of questions from the audience. Thank you.
Yeah, we thought we'd move slightly away from scientifically and talk about some of the intersections of science and the way we interact with the environment. And We encourage interruptions and disputes. So if you have a question, come on up to one of the microphones. We have one at the end of each aisle. And I just want to start off by commenting on something you said about the thresholds of safe versus unsafe. I think if I'm correct about it, the context of safe versus unsafe is we know within range that recovery is possible, that the consequences are manageable in a sense, and you know, beyond that, it becomes a question mark, and particularly for greenhouse gases, we're dealing with a threshold such as during the last time we were between glacial cycles where the temperatures we know have gone a couple degrees warmer than they were pre-industrial, and everything has turned out okay in a sense, and now we're beyond that. And of course it's very difficult for scientists to state what the consequences of going beyond that are, because we don't have the examples in history to say what's happening.
Yeah, that's a really good point. My friend Mark Linus wrote a book a few years ago called 6 Degrees, where he tried to look at how the planet would change with each degree centigrade of warming. And what happened was, once he got beyond 2 degrees, he couldn't find any scientific papers, except for ones in deep history where humans weren't here and most of today's species were here. So for me, one of the frontiers for scientists is, can we actually model what species would look like across the West in a West that was 8 degrees warmer, let alone before we get to tipping points. So there's actually some big research gaps here, I think, as we look to the future about what we might expect. It's the same with food security. You know, how would we actually map going forward what the world food system would look like in a warmer environment. So a lot of times we are relying on models in order to try to look to the future with all of the limitations of models. But we do know, my understanding is that from the past, we do know we've gone through periods of rapid climate change before. And my colleague, Connie Woodhouse, who's been reconstructing the Colorado River flow, has seen in the deep past some pretty rapid changes in the flow of the rivers in the West, which makes her think that we could have, you know, similar rapid changes in the future.
When I got a few comments on some of the exhibit items, I want to talk about one right now, which is David Buckland's engine, which, of course, the reaction seeing it running out there in the courtyard was, turn that damn thing off. it's emitting carbon. Yeah, that's bad. But that got me thinking about how it is we decide what's good and bad about the climate system. I think it's fair to say that value judgment of good versus bad is something that resides in us as human beings, that the natural environment really doesn't know about those qualities. We went through, until about 20,000 years ago, a major glacial cycle where large portions of the Earth were covered by ice. Glaciers were scouring out valleys and mountains, and I think we tend to regard that as simply being an event that happened, and it's part of our history, and it wasn't a good thing or a bad thing to have happened. It's part of what happened, and it led to the Earth the way it is. And I think as humans, we tend to value keeping the Earth the way it is. We have this sense of history and place that we value that's apart from natural evolution. Amy Balkin's exhibit on artifacts from place touches on this. But the places that we experience now and the environments, including the climate and the ecosystems and so forth, have changed quite a bit in geologic time, even recent geologic time. 8,000 years ago, forests were covering the mountains and grasslands in the valleys in this part of the world, and the climate has changed as the glaciers have melted. And we don't view the glaciers melting as a bad thing because it left this as a desert. We take this as a desert, and we think of this being a desert as inherently part of what it is. But it says it's part of our experience of this place. And the fact that we're changing that experience and modifying the climate. You know, the numbers that we're talking about, the worst case of 8 degrees Fahrenheit change in a century. In ecosystem terms, if the ecosystem is able to adjust, that corresponds to essentially all the ecozones migrating about 2,000 or 3,000 feet up the mountains, so that the ecosystem here would be like the ecosystem down at the Rio Grande River in Big Bend National Park, and the ecosystem in the Fort Davis Mountains would look like what's here in the valleys right now. And those are major changes that in nature that we attach a value to, but it's our experience and how we relate to nature that makes that valuable. Other aspects of climate change are quantifiable, like economic costs of adaption, dealing with sea level rise and so forth, as well as non-ecological human costs of populations that don't have the ability to pay for adaptation, which is another cost that you can't really attach a monetary value to, but obviously is a value to us as human beings and a part of the world society.
I'll just make a brief comment and then we maybe could get some questions. I think for me that we had a conference in Tucson in May, which was an international conference on climate adaptation. And first of all, it was amazing. We had about 800 people come, including a delegation of 70 from Australia, who see that the problems they're experiencing with the terrible fires that they had and droughts are very similar to what we have in the Southwest. And they came to share experiences. But one of the big discussions we had was around endangered species and ecology, because we may say, well, we can adapt, but are we going to let the pika go extinct? Because the pika is the small pika that you see on the mountains in Colorado. You know, it doesn't have anywhere to go. I mean, the mountains aren't high enough for it to escape global warming and for many of the world's birds. So in Australia, they're actually really having serious planning of moving species to Tasmania, to nearer the pole, as a form of adaptation. And then we're starting to think of what we started calling it is the difference between incremental adaptation and transformative adaptation, where you move your cities away from the coast, where you start moving species around the planet. And that's a completely different sort of relationship to nature that we would be taking up. And of course, a few years ago, I was at a conference in California about geoengineering. And I expect many of you are familiar with the idea that one of the ways we might want to cope with climate change is if we can't give up fossil fuels, then we need to find some way to compensate for it. And so they're talking about spraying particles into the atmosphere to cool the climate. We're talking about very dramatic ways of trying to store carbon. And those sort of geoengineering solutions, in some ways, may be the only solution, because we won't be able to adapt to the climate changes that are happening. And so, having been completely against geoengineering for a very long time, I now think, well, we should probably do the research. I don't ever want us to use it, but if we got into rapid climate change, we might have to use it as the lesser of the evils to maintain a livable planet. So, should we see if anybody in the audience would like to ask a question or make a comment?
I want to ask about some potential solutions, which are off-the-shelf technologies. In the 1970s, I worked at a refinery in Virgin Islands, and we provided all of our water through desalination. We sold the water to ships that came by. Why can't we be providing all the industrial water, commercial water, along the coast through desalination and keep the rest for our needs? The other thing is, after the disaster in Japan, the Japanese have been working on providing solar power from the moon. They have a concept where they'll use satellites. David Criswell at the University of Houston, worked there for 35 years with NASA, had developed a plan to provide solar power to the Earth from the moon. These concepts that use today's technology, they put solar powers on the moon, the screens, they build them on the moon, and they transform the power of the microwaves, and they bring the microwave energy down to big antennas, rectennas on the Earth. Why aren't we talking about these technologies that are been around for 35 years? He's been funded by NASA. He's presented in front of Congress. Help me out on that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'll take a start at the desalination because it is a big area of research at my university. And the major problem with desalination has been the amount of energy that it uses, and it's mostly been using fossil fuel energy. So whilst you're solving the water problem, you're making the greenhouse warming problem worse. So what we're doing on a much smaller scale is try to look at solar desalination. In terms of putting in desal plants across the world as a solution to both water problems and global warming, there are a lot of countries. Mexico's putting in desal plants throughout Baja. Australia, the state of Victoria, is investing in desal plants. But I think we have to ask the question when it comes to water is, we're using water quite inefficiently in a lot of places, and it might be a lot cheaper to go for efficiency than build these desal plants. For me, the desal should be the sort of maybe last thing that we do. In terms of generating energy from sort of really advanced technologies, I think that there's a lot of problem with public perception that we would have to deal with. It's whether it's nuclear power or geoengineering or solar from the moon, I think there are all sorts of potential in terms of public fear and unacceptability. And for me, the solution we should be looking at is commercial, sort of municipal level solar. We are almost at the point where we can generate solar very well in sort of utilities, although we need to be careful where we put it because there's problems with tortoises, for example, in our part of the world in the desert. But one of the reasons I sort of resist putting solar photovoltaic on my roof is I want my utility to go photovoltaic. My university's gone photovoltaic, but I want the utility to do it because then the poor people in my community will be able to get renewable energy as well. They can't afford it.
Yeah, a couple other comments. With regard to desal, one great model that people don't think about much is actually over in El Paso, one of the largest desal plants in North America. They are not piping water up from the Gulf of Mexico and cleaning it. They're piping water from a brackish underground water source, brackish being too much salt or other minerals to be able to be used as drinking water, but generally not nearly as unpalatable as seawater. And the costs are pretty much proportional to the amount of minerals you have to remove. So there's a large, largely untapped, body of underground water, which is partly a renewable resource because it gets recharged but then passes through, dissolves minerals and so forth, that is more economically viable than ocean water desalination. You also don't have to worry about piping the water uphill as you would in much of the United States where the oceans are quite some distance. In regard to the solar technologies, the problem usually, as I think it is here, is cost. Solar power is, with subsidies, viable on a small scale. It has to be viable on Earth before it's viable to put in the additional investment to install it on a on the moon or have satellite collectors, which might also be possible. And furthermore, it's unfortunately something that's a payoff over a long period of time, which is very difficult in today's political climate to conjure up the money to invest again. And it's hard to get private economic investors to invest for something that long term also.
Let me just ask a couple quick questions as a lay member of a audience, which if it's anything like me is pretty overwhelmed by the information that you've provided. Are you in agreement that the surge to the 400 parts per million level is either largely or entirely a result of man-induced factors? First question. Second, I couldn't quite tell if you were being respectful of each other and diplomatic or if there is really a strong disagreement, but do you disagree with one another over the question of whether modeling can be used to reliably predict future climate behavior at this point? And then could you both speculate on what on earth are the primary factors that are blocking this society and presumably other civilized nations from addressing the findings that science has provided us and incorporating the implications of these findings into aggressive responses?
You can go first.
All right. 400 is indeed man's responsibility.
And women, we're responsible for a little bit of
it. Okay, some of it. if you divide things up by gender of CEO, man is mostly responsible.
Yeah, okay.
So the statistics you often hear in dispute of that is that man is emitting such and such amount of carbon dioxide, whereas nature emits 30, 40, 50 times that amount each year. What's going on here is that we had a balanced carbon cycle before, where plants will take up CO2 as they grow and make plant material. Eventually they die, they decay, that carbon goes back into the environment. But there's no net change in the amount of carbon in the atmosphere due to the life cycle of a plant, except for a small amount of carbon that might get stuck in the soil and not be available. In the ocean, there's a large exchange of carbon back and forth because carbon dioxide is a soluble gas, as well as plankton utilizing photosynthesis. So that hits a balance, which can be disturbed. So, for example, during the ice ages, that balance was a lot lower value of carbon dioxide because it's more soluble when the temperatures are colder and the plant activity is different. But there's been no major change of the climate or the ecosystem to cause that balance to change other than what we've done. So right now the change in carbon dioxide concentration from 200 years ago to now is larger than the change between an ice age climate and a non-ice age climate. The amount that we put in is approximately twice the increase. So nature is helping us out some of it's getting absorbed into the oceans, which is one way that we can tell the oceans aren't a source of carbon dioxide, because they're actually emitting, they're absorbing it rather than emitting it. The concentrations are going up in the ocean. And also plants are, in some sense, happy about the carbon dioxide because that's something they need to grow. If they're not otherwise nutrient limited, they grow faster with carbon dioxide. And again, some evidence says they might even be more drought resistant with carbon dioxide. But yeah, that's all us. I'll touch on modeling and then turn it over to you to follow up on that, because I probably came off as being down on modeling. Modeling gives us physically consistent representations of what can happen, which is a lot better than random guessing. It's consistent with the models are designed to be consistent with everything that we can observe, and they match pretty well what we can observe. Even at that, models give us a range of scenarios for the future, because we don't know exactly how sensitive the climate system is to changes in carbon dioxide, because of a certain increase has a direct effect on the radiation budget of the Earth, but then other things respond, like concentration of water in the atmosphere and the whole hydrologic cycle. So that's only pinned down right now to within about a factor of 2 or 3, and models haven't really shrunk that range much. But the problem, of course, is that while it's such a large range, that means that our threshold of safety is also large. So the fact that models can't actually do an excellent job of forecasting what's going to happen means that we, as a society, have to play things a lot safer than we might end up having to be, because those high-end scenarios are still within play.
Okay. Yes, I agree that the 400 parts per million is anthropogenic or human caused. I've seen nothing to convince me otherwise. On models, I think we're probably in about the same place. The one thing I would say that because I work a lot on the impact of climate change in different parts of the world, my major concern, I'm pretty confident that the models are doing they're doing well at giving us a sense of what global temperatures are going to look like. What I'm worried about is a lot of people are asking me, like, what's it going to look like where I live? And the models aren't very good at giving us accurate data. It's called downscaling it to where we live. And I'm particularly worried about rainfall. I do some work with Oxfam, the humanitarian organization, and they're trying to plan for the future in terms of the poor and humanitarian emergencies in the developing world. And there are large parts of the developing world where the models currently can't tell you whether it's going to get wetter or drier. So that makes it, you know, hard. Though you do know that most of the reason people are starving is poverty. So you could start by dealing with poverty and then deal with climate change. But I think what should be convincing the public, and this moves to the last question, is that it used to be that all we really had were the models. I mean, when I first got into this field 30 years ago, there weren't really indications very much that the climate was changing. In the 30 years that I've been in this area, the evidence is just coming in one year after another, and it's completely consistent with what the models said 30 years ago when I was first studying this. So for me, it's the observational, experiential evidence that should be starting to convince people. And that also should convince people that the models are actually perhaps better because they were able to project pretty accurately where we are right now. In terms of what's blocking decisions, I could answer this either with my political self or with my social science self. I'll start with my social science self, which is a lot of people in the rest of the world think that it's the American public that's blocking decisions here. But people like Tony Leisterowitz, who does regular surveys of the American public, and John Krosnick at Stanford, very good social science work, they find consistently that the majority of the American public believes that global warming is happening, and the majority thinks that it's because of humans, and the majority thinks that the government should and we should do something about it. Now, a majority is more than 50%, but that's all about all we ever get in this country in elections and other things. So that suggests that it's perhaps not the public that's stopping action on global warming, but that it's politicians and the question of whether they understand what their public thinks. And in fact, John Krosnick's latest research is very interesting in terms of the upcoming election. He studied the last three elections as to whether speaking out on concern about climate change and the environment helped or hurt you, whether you were a Republican or a Democratic candidate. And he finds almost universally that speaking out, if you like, speaking green, saying that you're concerned about climate change increases your chances of being elected, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. So I think that sort of social science research is very interesting in terms of understanding what's going on. So that perhaps leaves us with special interest influence on politicians rather than sort of the voting influence on politicians. And so perhaps then that leads us to question, okay, who's supporting politicians? What's the role of corporations? But there's some really interesting research there as well that shows that many of the world's best run and best known corporations are now taking climate change extremely seriously. I was in Rio for the Rio summit at the beginning of the summer, and there were dozens of major corporations there who are taking climate change very seriously. And the reason is they've got long-term horizons, and they're they're worried that climate change is going to undermine their investment, or that we're going to get rapid climate change where regulation will come down on them very fast. And so they're looking ahead much further than the politicians. But perhaps those companies are not the ones that are influencing elected officials. So that's a sort of a convoluted analysis, but I've tried to actually answer it as a scientist. I could just be a complete political cynic, but I'll leave that one.
And since I'm just a physical scientist, I won't answer it at all, but just circle back to something that Dan talked about, which is regional difficulties with future climate. And a concrete example of that is El Nino and La Nina. The Southwest U.S. is very sensitive to that particular cycle. If you have an El Nino, almost always you're going to have a cool and wet winter time, and we have one developing right now, so cross our fingers on that. La Nina is just the opposite, and it's a major impact. We're talking 20% to 30% difference between normal. So the difference between an El Nino and La Nina is close to half of rainfall. The physical phenomenon of El Nino and La Nina is basically what we call an instability in the ocean and atmosphere in the tropics, where it likes to be in one state for a while, but then something kicks it and it goes off into a different state for a while, and it goes back and forth, unfortunately, at an irregular time scale about every few years. But that depends on subtle characteristics of how the ocean temperatures change with depth and how strong the winds are. About half of the climate models until recently would either have the ocean being in a permanent El Nino state or a permanent La Nina state. And apparently, this is just this narrow window of circumstances where it goes back and forth. And we know from paleoclimate evidence that in the past, it has been locked into one state or the other for decades on end, and probably permanently in one or the other during the last glacial cycle. So obviously it's very important to know what's going to happen to El Nino, La Nina in the future, and that was one of the tipping points on Dan's slide. Well, there have been about three separate review articles that have come out in the past few years looking at all the evidence for changes in El Nino and La Nina, and the unanimous conclusion is we don't know. There are some factors that point in one direction, some factors that point in the other. It's not possible to tell with the modeling right now. It's not possible to tell with observations because it's so irregular. So this is something that we have no clue, really, how it's going to change. We only know that we're going to be awfully lucky if it doesn't change.
Yeah, and that's why I can't tell Oxfam how the rainfall is going to change, because a lot of the rainfall is influenced by that cycle. Is there another comment? Yeah.
Hi. Couple things. One, to try to, as a layperson, get a little handle on modeling and reliability and how concerned we should be of it and how much we can look to it. What I've been reading and what I've been hearing, it seems to me, is that the modeling that has already been done for what was predicted to have happened over the last 5 and 10 years is being exceeded on the high end.
Oh.
And so it's fairly consistent that even though we don't know what this modeling can do with regard to accuracy in the future, what we can know, this is a question, is it true that what we can know is that the modeling that has been done has been exceeded on the high end with regard to temperature change, CO2 change, glacial ice melt, et cetera? So that's one question. The other is, again, as a layperson, it seems to me that we may be at a fairly important time with regard to the scientific dialogue and the debate. And what is underneath that? And specific, I'm saying that some of the leading climate change deniers in the scientific community are changing their findings by doing more testing. But the finding is that, yes, humans are causing this. And quickly, and the ones that are being in large part funded by oil and gas interests are quickly going to the solution of natural gas and more petroleum products in the next step versus biting the bullet and going to an infrastructure of solar, et cetera. And so my question is, are you seeing that indication from the climate change deniers as well as these solutions? Because earlier, we made this comment, you know, if we're not going to give up on petroleum products, on fossil fuels. And I think we might be at this really critical juncture of whether we're going to go down the road of another 100 years of fossil fuels or really look at what these alternatives are. And I think the industry, and I'm about to finish here, but if I'm right, and the industry is beginning to take up the song of it is man-made, but here's our solution, they're ready to invest this next 100 years of infrastructure. And so, you know, your comments on that. Thank you.
Mm. Well, in terms of the models, in terms of where we're at exceeding the model projections, that's partly because the emissions are higher than the original models were assuming. My understanding of, in terms of the model forecasts, is that for a global average temperature change, there have now been 5 IPCC assessments, which are the global assessments where all the climate scientists get together, and that the average temperature hasn't changed very much in those forecasts. I think what's happened is that the range of possible scenarios, like the driving forces, the emissions, have gotten much higher. So now they've just changed all of the assumptions they're making in the climate models because they're having to include emission scenarios that have much higher emissions because we're emitting more than they assumed we would a few years ago. On the second issue about the deniers, I think I'd like to make a clarification or a distinction between a climate skeptic and a climate denier. A climate skeptic, you could actually think of a skeptic as being a good thing if you're a scientist. In fact, science is built around skepticism. The whole scientific model is, I'm not going to believe it until you prove it to me, I mean, in a simple way. And a climate denier doesn't want to look at any of the scientific data in some cases. So the Berkeley group, which is the one that has had the big impact, they were skeptical about some of the data analysis. So they did it themselves and came out and said, this is a group that produced a report funded partly by the Koch brothers who are involved in the fossil fuel industry. And that report came out and said, yes, the Earth is getting warmer. We've reanalyzed the data. We're no longer skeptical about that particular variable. But the climate deniers would still say, no, we don't even want to hear that. So there are skeptics who are becoming less skeptical about certain things. And I also think we need to separate out what we're disagreeing about. And I often try to do this when I am talking to people who are more skeptical, is I said, well, let's first of all see if we agree about whether it's getting warmer. Secondly, whether it's anthropogenic. Thirdly, what the future's going to look like. And I actually usually try to get them to the point where what we're really disagreeing about is the solution, not about the science, because it's very disturbing that there's so much disagreement around the science. And sometimes if you talk it through, you can get to it's the solutions that we're disagreeing about.
But. And to some extent, it's become part of the identity of one of our two political parties to be skeptical about climate changing. And it's true that evidence of our impact is increasing steadily over time. You know, for example, there was a period of time when the satellite data wasn't showing an increase, but then they found an error with that, and it's gotten longer, and so the trend is more and more robust. So if you're looking at the weight of evidence, it's getting, you know, higher and higher on the this is a significant problem side. But the public doesn't look at weight of evidence. They get their information from the news, and if they already are invested in a point of view, they're paying attention to those things which confirm their points of view. So if you had, if there were 10 studies that said climate change wasn't a problem, 100 that were, they paid attention to those 10 studies. And now if you have another 100 studies and only one of them is skeptical, now it's up to 11. The evidence is increasing that climate change is not happening because of selective intake and acceptance of information. So that's very difficult to overcome while we have the range of inputs going on here, including special interest funding, people that are paid to pipe out as many skeptical stories as possible. Going back to question about modeling, that touches on something that I'd like to just mention briefly, which also goes back to the reason why we haven't narrowed that range of possibilities so much. You'd think, well, if we've had 120 years, we know how much CO2 has increased. Should be simple. But there's multiple causes of climate, and one of them that's also anthropogenic is increases of tiny particles in the atmosphere, which we call them aerosol particles, even though they're not coming from a spray can, they're mostly coming from coal-fired power plants. And they affect cloud cover. They generally have a cooling effect on temperature. So we're doing one thing, which is rising, causing the global temperature to rise. We're doing another thing, which would cause the global temperature to cool. And what's actually happening is somewhere in between. And the problem is this cooling effect, because it involves simulating clouds and all that, is really very difficult for models to pin down. So that's a cause of the uncertainty. And now as we deal with climate change and try to clean things up, if we eliminate emissions from coal-fired power plants, the carbon dioxide that they emitted is staying in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. The aerosols that they emitted are gone after 1 or 2 years. And so we're in danger of having to deal with more rapid climate change if we are able to implement a solution quickly. It's like that we're on this plane that we have to, it's not a matter of getting it down to the ground, it actually has to land safely. So it's more complicated than simply reducing emissions, and that takes care of it all.
I think we should probably wrap up, but I just want, maybe we could both make a couple of wrapping up comments. One is, I hope you can tell that when John and I talk about this, we actually are excited about the science as well as being worried by what it says. And one of the things I got asked by somebody recently was, well, you've been doing this for 30 years, don't you get sort of really depressed? And I think it was Adrian was saying she was feeling very dark. And I think part of being a researcher in this area is that it's so interesting. I mean, it's just absolutely fascinating. There's always some new wrinkle to this. There's so much uncertainty that as a researcher, it's exciting, even though for the planet, it can be pretty horrific. And the other comment I wanted to make, which also links back to the art panel, was both Amy and Adrian were talking about mapping and the visuals that they produce in their art. And as I was watching Richard present, particularly when he said we had to change the color on the map, I was thinking, are these scientific graphics we present a form of art? And actually, they're probably, even those are constructed because we choose what colors to put on the map. Like, we don't have to show red. It just looks scarier if we put red. And so, you know, are we actually, as we construct our graphics, creating art? And if we spent more time with the artists, might we produce even more convincing graphics? So, did you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll just... Thank you. Yeah, if anybody wants to invest in a cool technology global warming visualization project, I've got an idea. We can talk later. Another one of the exhibits was Sinan Prashad's one-ton of CO2 graphic, and which was actually a physical demonstration of how big one ton of CO2 is. And it's hard to get a sense of that air actually weighing a ton because of the way our perceptions work with respect to air. But it suggests there's another way of visualizing it, which is if you were to stack three of those up, so you've got this column that's 72 feet tall, or 78 feet tall, if I do the math right, that's about how much carbon dioxide would have been in the whole column of the atmosphere in pre-industrial times. And that sounds like it's not a whole lot. And in fact, what we've done to the planet since then is add one more block up there, so now it's stacked four times tall, it's up to 100 feet. And it doesn't seem like it should do much, but imagine if those blocks were filled with smoke, so that if you get three or four of them, you can't really see through it anymore. That's basically what it's doing to the infrared part of the atmospheric spectrum. There's a certain range of wavelengths where it looks like smoke. And so the emission, what the Earth is emitting is radiation, can't get through it, and what it's emitting is coming up from someplace that's a lot colder. So that's physically what's happening. We're putting the equivalent of smoke in the atmosphere, and it's changing everything.
Well, that maybe that's the concluding art project, is that if we could turn all greenhouse gases violent pink color, then people might believe that they were causing a problem. But I think would sure. be okay to wrap up.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you all for listening, and thanks for having us here.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Diana and John. I'm enlightened. I don't know about you guys, but I'm totally enlightened from all that information. Anyway, that concludes our second discussion. Please come back for Michael Pollan and Hamilton Fish in discussion later in a couple hours, basically at 6 o'clock. I think we'll open doors at around 5:30 for seating, so it's in about an hour. Anyways, thank you again, and thank you, Diana.
And meanwhile, go out and buy some books. I did.
Yes, buy some books, for sure.